Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Missed calls and arguing with the umpire are staples of baseball. However, a new technology tested in the minor leagues and the recent All-Star game could be making a big change. The Automated Balls and Strikes, or ABS, system would allow hitters and pitchers to challenge a call at the plate, adding a new wrinkle into America's national pastime. Joining me to talk about it is Associated Press baseball writer Ron Blum. Ron, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you give us some background? How does this automated balls and strikes system work?
There are Hawkeye cameras posted around the stadium focused in on the strike zone. So it's the same sort of technology that's been used in tennis for calling serves and balls in and out. And a lot of the debate and the testing the last few years has been involved in deciding the shape of the strike zone, because it's been an open secret in baseball for 100 years that the strike zone in the rule book, which is a cube, is not what's called by umpires, who call sort of an oval.
Okay. So, and can this system make the strike zone change depending on, I guess, the height of the player and how he stands at the plate? So is it?
Yes, they take a distance based on the height of the player, and they've been toying with that through the tests in the minor leagues. But it means Jose Altuve and Aaron Judge will have different strike zones.
Right, as they should, I guess. So this system's been used in the minor leagues for a few years now. Has it been working well?
Yeah, what they found, they first tested it in two different ways. They tested having all balls and strikes called by the computer robot, and they tested a challenge system of which the human umpire makes the call, and each team gets a set number of challenges. They started with three, then two. And so if there's an egregious call that either the batter, the catcher, or the pitcher don't like, they can appeal to the computer. And if you're successful and win your challenge, you don't lose it. So if you start with two and you win a challenge, you keep two.
And what's been the results of challenges? Are most of them overturned, or does the umpire make good calls and the computer says good job?
It changes each test, but the low 52, 53, 54% have been overturned. So more than not.
Okay. So more than half. Yeah.
Like we see with the baseball replay, what happens in the later innings, if a team has challenges left, they're likely to use it rather than not use it. And those are the ones that more often aren't successful.
Do you get two challenges per game or per inning? I missed what you
said. Per game.
Per game.
Per game.
Okay.
So you start with two. If you have an egregious one in the first inning, you challenge it and you're right, you still keep two. But if you're wrong, you're down to one.
Okay. Are more teams using them in like the eighth and ninth inning than in the first inning then?
They tend to use them more in the late innings and the early innings.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So the system decided was to be used in the All-Star game. So it made its major league debut of sorts. How did it go in the All-Star game?
There were five challenges and four of the five were successful.
Okay. So meaning the umpire in that case, the All-Star game umpire was incorrect four times?
Yeah, but it's a tough business, and the plate umpire, Danny Iasanja, is one of the really good umpires.
Yeah. So I read in an interview, Pittsburgh Pirates pitcher Paul Skeens said that every pitcher thinks everything he throws is a strike. So he thinks pitchers should probably have no say in this.
Yeah, and a lot of the pitchers are so focused on the pitching. Most of them have delegated the decision whether to challenge to their catchers. And the challenge The way you signal a challenge is you just tap your head.
So the catcher or who's tapping their head?
Or the pitcher could. In fact, Tariq Skubal, the American League starter in the All-Star game, said he wouldn't challenge, but then in his one first inning, he did challenge, but his catcher was slightly ahead of him and challenged first.
Okay. And now what about the fans? Do fan like this has been in the minor leagues for a little while now. Do the fans like it?
Yeah, and the fans see a computer graphic on the stadium video board, and the fans watching at home also see that same computer graphic, which will show where the ball is against the strike zone. What they're still working out is the computer robot is not 100% accurate. There's a certain level of inaccuracy that's less than half an inch. How much less than half an inch is subject to debate.
A half an inch. Oh my goodness. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the use of automated balls and strikes in Major League Baseball with Associated Press baseball writer Ron Blum. So if the system is effective, will baseball just do away with the human umpires behind the plate?
No, because they found during the testing that they liked the challenge system more than the all-computer system. And middle of the 2024 season at AAA, they went to an all-challenge system while they had been doing it half and half previously.
Well, how do the umpires feel about this? I mean, do they love their jobs and don't want a computer to take it over?
Yeah, there's a split feeling. These guys all want to be 100% correct. You rarely are 100% correct in a game with 250 to 400 balls and strikes to call. A lot of them, they're swings and foul balls, but there's still a ton to call. So the most important thing is to get it right. And what Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred has said is you don't want to be in a position where the umpires are the only ones who don't know what the actual, where the ball crossed.
Now, Wimbledon, as you mentioned, did away with the human line judges and are using computers for that. So are we going to see more robotic referees in the future of sports, basically?
I would think, especially on where lines are and something in or out, yes. They can't replace judgment on a lot of these calls in all sports, like what is a foul in basketball? What is a foul in soccer? In baseball, some things can't be judged by a computer because they're moving too fast. A slide across the plate, does the ball tag get the runner or does it miss? That will unlikely be ever called by a computer.
Yeah. Well, how about the pace of play for baseball? That's been a major concern in recent years. They've been trying to make Major League Baseball games faster. There's now that count of how many seconds a pitcher has until he has to throw the next ball. Will this slow down the game?
Not really, because in the testing with the computer call, it's a matter of 2-3 seconds before between the challenge and you get the graphic.
Does the computer system talk, like, over the scoreboard? Do you hear it say things, or is it just
No, it's just, there's no reason. You see a line, and it either hits in or hits without. There's no need for it to explain.
Okay, well, go ahead.
The one that talks is the PitchCom system that they've been using for several years, where the catcher signals for fastball, curveball, and that, and they hear a computerized voice in the pitcher's earphone.
Oh, okay. All right. And I guess a part of baseball is just because some umpires do it differently than others, but hearing the umpire call it from behind the plate, I mean, that's just like a part of the game, right? You don't want to lose that.
Exactly. And that would remain, because with the system now, there'll always be a human umpire making the initial call.
Do you feel like this is a good move for baseball in a big picture?
Yeah, it's an inevitable move, because you don't want games decided by wrong calls. Here we are 24 years later, and people are still talking about the Yankees Padres World Series opener and Richie Garcia making the wrong call on a 2-2 pitch to Tino Martinez, and then on the next pitch, him hitting a grand slam that gave the Yankees a 4-run lead.
Right, because that should have been,
It should have been strike three on the on a pitch earlier.
Yeah, he should have never had a chance at that Grand Slam. I get it. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so are we going to see this system in baseball next season?
It's not 100% sure, but it's likely. Commissioner Rob Manfred's in favor, and he said it's going to be considered by the 11-person competition committee, and management holds a majority of the votes on that competition committee. So it seems like it will happen for the 2026 regular season.
Mm. Okay, when does that have to be decided by, I guess, to implement it?
I mean, it could be any time during the off season. What we've seen with big changes is the competition committee usually meets September-ish before the end of the regular season.
Okay. Is it expensive for each stadium to install this?
Well, there's so many cameras now in the stadium that the increased cost, I'm guessing, I haven't asked, is incremental, because all the data that we as fans are used to, the velocity of pitches, how far the ball goes, that's all tracked by Hawkeye cameras that are installed in major league stadiums. And when they play at an unusual stadium, like they will at the Bristol Speedway next month or the Little League Classic in Williamsport or London, they have to install all that Hawkeye technology for that game.
Oh, okay. So they can bring it in. It doesn't have to like live at the stadium. They can bring
exactly.
in all the cameras. Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. That was Associated Press baseball reporter Ron Blum. Ron, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Yes. And coming up, we're going to talk about weather forecasting, how a forecast is made and what technology is used. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Extreme weather events pose a major threat to millions of people across the country. Just recently, flash flooding in central Texas caused devastation with more than 130 deaths. And even with the best technology, predicting the weather is incredibly difficult and requires a great deal of technical and geographical knowledge. We're discussing what goes into producing a weather forecast and how forecasters work to spread awareness. Joseph Chan is an assistant professor at Ohio State's Geography Department, where he works with weather forecasting data and works on ways to improve atmospheric forecasts. Welcome, Joseph.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Amy. I'm excited to be here to talk about this very honestly, very little known process in meteorology.
Yes. And we also have Jana Hauser. She is an associate professor in Ohio State's Geography Department, where she analyzes tornadoes and the rotating storms that produce them. She also teaches classes in weather forecasting and observation, among others. Welcome to All Sides, Jana.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
All right. So let's start with what role each of you play in creating a weather forecast. Jana, let's start with you. Tell me about analyzing rotating storms.
Yeah. So the data that I collect specifically generally doesn't make it into the forecast right away. But what I do is I look for the pieces of the puzzle that can then inform our physics within the models that create the forecast. Then we can use that information to identify conditions and storms that are going to be rotating in our weather model framework.
And Joseph, tell me about improving atmospheric forecasts. What work do you do in that area?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I work on how to convert measurements of the atmosphere into information we can use for weather forecasting. So this typically involves gathering the observations, which I don't do. I stay in my, behind my computer to do all the algorithms, and then we have algorithms to translate those observations into things that the computer models can use for weather forecasting. So I work on improving those algorithms.
Okay, so you're working on the computers behind the scenes, trying to get them to do a better job. Can you talk to me about how technology has changed to forecast the weather in recent years? Because I'm sure, I mean, everything with technology changes a lot.
Yes, things have changed a lot over the past couple of years. So just, so one way I like to think about it is like having a camera. So in many ways, there are some similarities between taking pictures as well as weather forecasting. And so like, over the past couple of years, our ability to capture increasingly small events have gotten better. That's in part because we have much bigger computers now to work with. Aside from that, we also are able to use more observations now in our weather forecasting. So, a couple of years ago, we were basically unable to use like geostationary satellite observations. Now we can. Now we're able to use those a huge swath of observations and put that into our models and make them better.
Okay. Yeah, I would think that satellites would play a role in weather forecasting, but you're saying it's more recent than I would think?
So there are sort of shades of improvements. So many, many years ago, we were barely able to use observations that are not contaminated by clouds, because clouds really, really mess up the calculations for infrared. And nowadays, we are increasingly able to use those cloudy observations. And I think and we're still working on it, because, again, clouds are really messy. And they are very complicated. So that affects how we can utilize those observations.
And Jana, tell me about your thoughts on improving technology in recent years.
Yeah, so in the severe weather realm, one of the really great improvements that we've made is called worn-on forecast. And what that does is it basically rapidly takes in a whole lot of data from various different sources, including weather balloons, including the satellite measurements that Joseph just alluded to, radar data, et cetera, and creates probabilistic forecasts in terms of statistics and probabilities. So what is the probability that a given storm is going to have rotation, for example, in its lowest 1 kilometer or so? And we produce these every 30 minutes or so. So we can rapidly get updates on the changing atmosphere in real time almost, and create better forecasts for the near term. So this is really going to help out in things like tornado prediction, possibly even issuing warnings in advance based on the data that we're seeing in a model, and not even so much as what we're seeing observationally, because observationally, severe weather and tornadoes are often very difficult to actually capture what is happening very close to the ground, which is, of course, where the biggest impacts exist.
Now, Joseph, you said that clouds get in the way and make it hard to forecast the weather, but if it's a clear day, we don't need the weather forecast if it's bright and sunny, right? So I would think that when we most need it is when it's the cloudiest. Is that the problem?
That is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. You've got it. So a lot of exciting things happen under clouds. Right. And so, but the trouble is with what is that the statistics I have to back up a little bit. So the way we use observations is that we need to run a bunch of models, generate some statistics to connect the observations to the weather that we can simulate in our models. And so the thing is, any statistics relating to clouds are incredibly messy and they're not easy to model at all. And so right now we make approximations about like the shape of the statistics. So for an example, we think things behave normally. Under a cloud, they don't behave normally. And so that can seriously mess up like the calculations that are used to convert the observations into something we can do in models. And that is a area that's going through a lot of research right now. And so as we are hoping to be able to incorporate more of this as time goes on, hopefully within the next 3 to 4 years.
Okay. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about extreme weather and why weather forecasting is so tricky. With us are Ohio State professors Joseph Chan and Jana Hauser. Jana, we recently had a show where we discussed weather forecasting, and I found out that we use weather balloons. I did not know. I don't know why. I just didn't. I thought weather balloons seemed like an old technology. But can you tell me about using weather balloons and what they can do?
Absolutely. Yeah. So weather balloons are an old technology. In fact, they have their beginnings back in the World War II era. And in fact, when we first got observations from weather balloons, people thought they were erroneous because they were hitting these really, really strong winds high above the air or high above the ground called the jet stream, which we have now since learned is crucial to understanding the relationship between what's happening at the ground and what's happening with this wavy pattern that we see in the upper level airstream called the jet stream. So what weather balloons do is they take kind of a point measurement by being released at a single location, and then the balloons go up. And as they go up, they measure temperature and moisture parameters, wind speed and wind direction, as well as the physical pressure reading at a specific height that the balloon is at. These elements are crucial to understanding weather forecasts and to generating good forecasts because there is this intricate link between what happens with the weather at the surface and what happens in the air and the winds aloft. The two are dynamically connected. When there's a feedback that happens, when something changes aloft, it changes at the surface. So getting correct observations at relatively high spatial resolution. So the more we can have over a given area, the better we can actually understand the current state of the atmosphere. And then if we understand the current state of the atmosphere, we can have a much, much more accurate forecast moving into the future. So when we start to yank some of these observations, like what has been happening because the National Weather Service is down on its number of staff, we start to actually take out pieces of the puzzle that then end up helping us hypothetically create a better forecast. So we end up having a scenario where our atmosphere is actually less predictable because we're not resolving it observationally as well as we could be had we had all of those observations in the first place.
And Joseph, you're nodding along. Do you like weather balloons?
Oh, I love them. Now, I'm going to tell you one of the biggest troubles we have with using satellites. Mm-hmm. So satellites don't provide us with things like temperature and humidity. All it tells us is what the color or the temperature of the Earth might be. Mm. I mean, and it's not even like the temperature of the air at a specific location. It's some strange sum of all the temperatures in the atmosphere. Mm. And so it's really complicated to use. And, you know, you have to do all these scary mathematics and physics of radiation to get an answer out of them. But weather balloons are beautiful because they are direct measurements of the things we care about. We call them in-situ measurements, like literally sticking a probe in the thing we want to measure. Mm. We don't have to make guesswork about like the properties of the atmosphere or anything like that. So weather balloons are basically to us the gold standard in many ways, and losing them would mean that it would become harder for us to predict the weather better simply because we don't have those direct measurements. So direct measurements are the best.
Okay. And Jana, you were mentioning the National Weather Service and NOAA. What effect have cuts had in the ability to make an accurate weather forecast? Are you saying that there's fewer weather balloons going up and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Many short-staffed Weather Service offices across the United States don't have the staff resources to have individuals get out there and release balloons. And I was out in the field this past May with some students, and we were storm chasing. And those morning and evening measurements are crucial to us to understand the overall structure of the atmosphere and to determine what the winds are doing, how the temperature is changing with height, and even like outside of the context of a numerical weather prediction model, having those observations to inform decision making while you're in the field to understand what the future is going to potentially hold are crucial. And there were many instances where some of the forecast offices across the Central Plains just didn't release balloons because they didn't have the people to do that. And so from a personal perspective, trying to go out and learn about the atmosphere, as well as a modeling perspective that really impacts every single person every single day, you know, I'm going to tangent here a smidgen, but we as weather forecasters and meteorologists oftentimes get a bad rap, and people are like, oh, you get to be right, or you get to be paid to be wrong in your job, but like all the time. And actually, that's, a little bit of a stretch to begin with, but we're seeing a trend where we're going to start going backwards because of the absence of these observations.
And Joseph, again, you are nodding along. Do you agree? Are we struggling with the National Weather Service and NOAA cuts? Is this going to impact future weather forecasts?
Absolutely. So, as Jana mentioned, weather balloons are really important for forecasting, as well as, just simulating the weather to make even further forecasts of the atmosphere, or even just to figure out whether a tornado is going to touch down in the next 3 hours. So that's very important. But like the NOAA funding cuts, they are not, what's going to happen is that not only are we going to lose a lot of these crucial weather balloon observations, what might happen is that our progress towards better weather forecasting is going to slow down, because these weather forecasts are not easy to make, right? You need these big, giant supercomputers to run all the calculations on, and every time you run a calculation, it costs money. We need to pay electricity. We need to have dedicated staff. We need to have people who understand what's going on with everything in there. And so, and then there's the research part, which is apparently going to suffer quite a bit under some of the budget proposals I've seen. And so, the past year, we have had a bunch of research proposals go into NOAA to talk about how we can to propose ideas to improve weather forecasting and to test whether the ideas we have are correct. And without the funds for these things, we are groping around in the dark. We don't know what might be the thing that brings our forecast to the next level. And so that is the sort of the issues that I can see coming from the proposed NOAA cuts. And I'm hoping that in the revised version of the budget, that the cuts will be less steep than the initial cuts we've seen.
And Jana, we have seen more devastating storms, more tornadoes. In 2024, there was news that Ohio led the nation in number of confirmed tornadoes. As of late April 2024, Ohio had 38, which surpassed Florida, Illinois, Kentucky, and Indiana. What is it about conditions in Ohio that led to so many tornadoes last year?
Yeah, there's a couple points I want to make here. One is, yes, last year was it smashed the record for the number of tornadoes in Ohio in any given year. I don't remember at the top of my head what those numbers ended up being versus the previous year or the previous record holding year, but it was significant, like over 20 tornadoes or so. And last year, what happened was we had a relatively mild winter, and we ended up getting a lot of early season scenarios where these very strong storm complexes, big low pressure systems that are the typical generators of lots of tornadoes in terms of the tornado outbreak type environments. And we just kept getting nailed with them. The way I had mentioned the jet stream earlier, which is kind of that wavy pattern of strong winds aloft, the way that was configured, we were just in this consistent state every 7 to 10 days or so, where we just kept getting repeat of tornado prone conditions. So that changes from year to year. Obviously, this year in Ohio, we have not seen anything near what we saw last year. And that interannual variability is what we call it. That's expected. But the degree to which we saw tornadoes last year is definitely unexpected. And another piece I wanted to throw in there is kind of linking the previous idea to this idea about severe weather and tornadoes. Tornadoes is the fact that the way tornado warnings are issued currently requires us to use radar data, us being weather forecasters at the National Weather Service. And if we don't have good radar observations, then we can't warn for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. We just don't have the observational capability. These things are relatively quickly evolving, they form fast, they change quickly, and there's no really good way to sample or observe these except by radar. So getting back to the idea of NWS cuts and limited resources, this puts a big strain on the individuals who are required to make these forecasts and the warnings specifically for tornadoes and severe thunderstorms, because that can be very exhausting and draining. And when you don't have a large enough pool of people to sort of share that load, the burnout and the work stress and the moment stress of what's happening at that specific time as you're trying to issue these warnings, it becomes very real and it becomes very heavy. And we will likely be seeing missed warnings even for no other reason than forecaster fatigue. But if we get into a situation where we stop having funding for our radar instruments, and by the way, little side note here, I mean, our radar instruments are in dire need of updates and upgrades. And in fact, the entire system is scheduled to be trashed at some point in time, or I'll say it was scheduled to be trashed, and a brand new system was supposed to be coming online here in the next 5 to 10 years. But right now that whole replacement process is in question and on hold. And if we don't start upgrading these things, we're gonna lose instruments simply because they're outdated and we don't have the old technology even available anymore to replace parts that are failing.
Joseph, let's talk about that idea of predicting emergency weather, because that was in the news a lot with these recent floods in Texas, about whether the National Weather Service did predict this properly. Was it a once in a lifetime, once in a one in a million storm, right? Do you feel like it is possible to predict that amount of rainfall and what will happen?
So to answer that, we need to take a little step back again and talk about how weather, like computer weather models, work and how we try to get them to predict these things. So what we do is that we run the same computer models many, many times to try and, throw darts at something to try and measure what the likelihood or the probability a particular kind of rainfall will happen. And with extreme rainfall, it is not easy at all to predict, simply because they are so rare that that models, you know, when we run the models many times, we may not run them enough times to capture all of this. Right now, I mean, we run 80 models at the moment, and that is simply not enough to capture the most extreme events and the statistics about it carefully. And so back to your question about the extreme rainfall, I believe that NWS did its job. I believe that they have done what they can. They have predicted the rainfall in advance, maybe not to that level, but they knew that something was going to happen. And I think what happened there might have been some kind of fudging or fumbling of the ball somewhere between.
There was a communication breakdown.
Correct.
Yeah.
I suspect that's what happened, but I was not there. Mm-hmm. Only the people there would know for sure.
Right.
So, yeah. Hope that answers your question.
Well, and Jana, you try to predict tornadoes by looking at rotation, but I mean, I have to imagine just feeling for the National Weather Service forecasters in Texas, where if you predict incorrectly too many times, people will stop listening to the warning. So you have to, there's probably a delicate balance there for you. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't want to be the boy who cried wolf, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. But in general, the National Weather Service does take a philosophy of communicating the sort of worst possible situation, because of the fact that if we're wrong, we would rather be wrong in the sense that we overpredicted something and saying it's going to be worse than it actually is than the opposite. In an event like what happened in Texas, I mean, the Weather Service did a good job in the context of the warning issuance, and even the weather models did a decent job at predicting the amounts of precipitation. But as was indicated, you know, there's this breakdown of communication that was very problematic. In this case, it was night. I've seen a lot of information kind of coming and going about you know, things happening at the camp, et cetera. But when it comes to the physics, like the models themselves can predict events like that. And they did predict with a pretty good reliability. In the context of a one in a million years type event, I mean, we don't have a million years worth of data, right? So we don't know what that really ends up looking like. But we do know that extremes, especially extremes in precipitation, both at the drought side of things and at the flood side of things, those are getting worse. They're getting more frequent. And it's starting to become more of a norm to get a 1 in a 500-year type event, 10 years in between. So it's the statistics are kind of hard to understand and not perhaps well explained in general.
Joseph, just to end on, what would you like people to know about predicting the weather and making a weather forecast? I mean, is it all science? Is there a little bit of art in there? Is it truly possible to accurately predict the weather every day?
And so someone almost got a Nobel Prize for this question. Mm. And so Ed Lorenz, I think it was 1960-some, discovered that you cannot predict the weather precisely. There will always be some amount of uncertainty because the weather is chaotic, as they say. And so there is a lot of science that goes on behind it. Fundamentally, it's all in the computer side of things. It's a lot of physics, a lot of mathematics, a lot of statistics. But then when it goes out to the forecasters, that's when the game changes a little bit. They will use their experience with the weather system in the general area to figure out whether or not to issue a warning. And so it's both an art and a science, but it's definitely a very heavily scientific field.
And Jana, we'll just end with you briefly. Is it an art? Is it a science? Can we predict the weather?
Yeah, so Joseph hit on the good Ed Lorenz metaphor there, or experience. But one thing to think about is the better we can observe the atmosphere, the better we can predict it. So there's a sort of saying, garbage in, garbage out. So if we're not observing things entirely, we'll never be able to predict them well in the first place. So this is the argument then for more observations. And as Joseph alluded to, unless we're really, having observations like every 3 meters or so, we're never going to, and obviously our system can't handle that, going to be able to achieve really high resolution, accurate forecasts out, a month, 2 months in advance. We have a threshold that we can approach on, and that's, on the order of maybe 5 to 10 days right now.
Jana Hauser, an associate professor in Ohio State's Geography Department, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Joseph Chan, assistant professor in Ohio State's Geography Department, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up, we're going to talk about data centers and charging them more for the enormous amount of utilities they use. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Data centers are crucial infrastructure for AI development and hosting web servers. Yet these data centers require massive amounts of power to remain operational. To counter that, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio will now allow data centers to be charged at a higher rate than other customers. This means AEP Ohio will now have separate rates for data centers. And Ohio residents won't have to worry about being charged large amounts of energy for what these data centers are consuming. Joining us to talk about it is Renee Fox, a WOSU reporter who has been covering the topic of data centers. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Renee.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So this settlement that was reached between the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, PUCO, and AEP Ohio, it's aimed at protecting their non-data center customers. Do I have that right?
Right. So anytime AEP Ohio is charging someone for energy, they're going to charge them in slightly different ways if they're a residential consumer like me or you, or if they're a commercial consumer or industrial consumer. So this decision allows AEP Ohio to create another one of those categories besides residential or commercial. This is data center. But so far, this only applies to AEP Ohio's territory. So people in other parts of Ohio might see their utilities come to the PUCO now to ask for the same kind of treatment.
Yeah. So before this change, were we paying for the were we supplementing data centers' energy use?
Well, I don't think that the AEP Ohio or the data centers or the PUCO would really phrase it that way. This is more to make sure that the upfront infrastructure costs that it will take to build up doesn't get passed along to other types of customers. So So in Central Ohio, we already have thousands of megawatts of energy being consumed every single day. And when data centers keep coming online and keep coming here, we might double how many megawatts we're using. So in order to do that, we have to build up a bunch of new transmission lines to get all that energy here. And what AEP Ohio wanted was to make sure that if they're spending money building up that transmission service, that the data centers weren't just going to pull out when the market wasn't as favorable to data centers, or if, say, another state became more favorable to data centers. They didn't want to see them flock away and leave those new transmission costs hanging over everybody else's heads.
Okay. Yeah. So do they have to pay it up front then? This is not like a over 30 years kind of thing then.
Right, right. These are longer contracts than other entities get with AEP Ohio usually. They want like a 12-year contract going into it with these data centers. And what they'll be doing is contracting them to pay for 85% of the costs that they said they were going to use. So say a data center comes in and says, oh, we want to use 1,000 megawatts of energy every day, which is a lot of energy. That probably wouldn't happen. But AEP Ohio would sign them up and say, okay, well, even if you don't use those thousands of that 1,000 megawatt of energy, you're going to have to use at least 850 megawatts and pay us for it. So it's basically a way of saying, if you're saying you're going to use the energy, you have to pay for at least 85% of what you're going to say.
If we're going to build up the infrastructure to support this energy, then you're going to have to pay for 85% of it.
Right, right. And it won't be a dollar for dollar cost recovery. These transmission lines will be in place over a long period of time. And the costs will kind of adjust over time.
Now, these data centers, they are just like big buildings full of power, right? Like there's not a bunch of humans working there, is that right?
Correct. There's been different analysis about just how many jobs they can create and whatnot, but I think most don't generate a lot of jobs. They do tend to take up a lot of space though, and Ohio has other tax credits that have made it more affordable to come here.
Basically, every time we do an internet search, like a Google search, a data center is powering that. Is that right. Correct? Is that too simple?
Yeah. Data centers power search, like your Google searches, and they actually become more energy intensive the more AI is used to help in those searches. And that's part of the big driver for the new data centers is the uptick in AI usage and the need for cloud capacity to store all of this information.
I read somewhere that using AI, like, such as ChatGPT, pulls more power, like you just said, but that even some of the executives of these companies are asking people when they use it to stop using extra words because it'll save power. Like I read an article where he said, you don't need to say please or thank you, just move on.
Well, for a lot of people, that's a hard habit to break, thankfully. But I think that I've also read that asking AI to generate images takes a lot more energy than asking it to answer a question.
So we should be thinking about using AI more thoughtfully, or here in Ohio, at least they're going to pay for the power now. So, oh, well, is that?
Well, perhaps. But using AI with more thoughtfulness, I think, is probably a good lesson for us all.
OK. So Ohio does have a lot of data centers. Do you happen to know? I don't know if we know numbers or how many. Do you not know that?
No, and there are different data centers of different sizes and scales. Like I interviewed a Columbus-based data center earlier this year that just serves local businesses that need some cloud solutions. They're in a smaller building. But they've been there for you know, more than a decade serving Columbus residents. But then you have other massive ones coming into town that are being built now from Amazon and Google that will process a lot more information than some of the smaller ones.
Now, a part of this plan with the PUCO and AEP Ohio will allow flexibility for these smaller and mid-sized data centers. So what you're talking about, the smaller ones, not your Googles, your Amazons, your Facebooks, but what kind of flexibility can they get there?
Right. The most stringent terms will only apply to the mega data centers, the ones that are using lots and lots of megawatts a day. The smaller ones won't really be concerned with those stringent rules. It's more about the amount of megawatts a organization is using than the label they give themselves.
Did the big data centers push back on this? Did they try to stop it?
Okay. Yeah. I covered hearings that they held back in, I want to say January, earlier this year. And there were droves and droves of attorneys coming in every single day. I'd never seen a PUCO hearing room so packed. And the attorneys were from all the mega branches, but also from like the Data Center Coalition, which represents groups of them, and they were shooting for a different agreement that they proposed that would have had them covering about 70% of their promised costs instead of 85%.
It's all a negotiation, though, right?
Right. Yeah, and the PUCO ended up adopting most of what AEP Ohio and the consumer protections people wanted.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we are talking about the large amount of electricity used by data centers and the rates utility companies charge these data centers. With us is WOSU News reporter Renee Fox, who has been covering the PUCO and AEP. So not all of these data centers are powered only by the grid. Recently, utility regulators allowed AEP Ohio to build on-site power generators at two of these large data centers. So how does that work? What are these generators doing? Where do they get their power from?
Yeah, these were just recently approved. They're still being constructed, or probably even in the planning stages of things. But basically, when AEP Ohio noticed all these data centers were coming and that their transmission was going to be stressed, they put a moratorium on bringing new data centers online to attach to the grid, saying it would just rob the grid of too much energy. So when they put the moratorium in place, which will be lifted with this new PUCO order, the other companies were like, well, hey, we still want our data center. What if we build on-site generation so we don't have to tap into the grid for so much energy? So they'll still be connected to the grid. They'll still be able to take a minimum amount of energy from the grid, but they'll have on-site batteries that work with I think they're called oxide batteries.
I have, natural gas and oxide fuel cells.
Yes.
Not that I know what that is, but that's what's written here.
Right. Yeah. From a company called Bloom, I believe. Mm-hmm. And they've created this way of doing it where they'll build the battery sites right there. AEP will run them and bill them for it. And it could be a really promising new way to see more of this generation without sucking so much energy from the grid.
So this is them trying to make their own power.
Right. And not to fully run it, just to supplement.
Okay. And so you're saying that the source of this is natural gas and oxide fuel cells, which I'm not going to pretend to really know what that is. What I would understand more is if they were putting these data centers are out in the middle of nowhere, if they were putting a bunch of solar panels on the roof. Do they do things like that?
We actually did ask about why solar panels if they would be a good option because of all that space covering just massive amounts of computers.
Yeah.
And actually because of just the way the energy is stored and how much renewables they would need on site, it just isn't scalable. There are some things that could work for, but just not such energy intensive things. So renewables are really good for being, you can have energy created right then and there and used right then and there, restored, but sometimes it's not great for massive amounts.
Okay. And this idea of allowing the data centers to have their own generators, is this something that had to be approved, though. Like, a data center can't just build a generator just for fun.
No, there are complexities about who's allowed to be a generator of electricity.
Oh, it's like creating your own electricity company.
Right. There's regulations. The PUCOS will approve things. And then there's also other parties that get interested in, and they say things like, oh, well, you know, if they're going to be creating their own energy, that kind of takes away business from us. It's not really fair.
Yeah. Okay. So they just made this deal, but then they're also allowing them to generate their own energy, right?
Right. So it's complex, I think, when you have this much going on in the energy world right now.
Now, I know you said you don't know the number of data centers Ohio has, but will we keep getting more? Or is this new plan that the PUCO and AEP, this agreement, is it going to keep data centers away in the future?
I think only time will tell for sure. But I mean, I was browsing through PUCO filings this week and saw one or two new ones that want to come up with their own on-site generation. So I have a feeling that that this might actually make it easier for the state to bring in more, because this was the first deal of its kind in the country, we're hearing. But so other places might have more stricter rules as everyone kind of catches up and sees what Ohio did.
Do you think this on-site generation is the future of how these are going to go, where they're going to all ask for that?
I think it's very likely. I do, after seeing after the success of the first one and then seeing new applications roll in. I think people have realized, like, yeah, we can do more if we take more of this on. But it's also up to AEP Ohio, because they have to
approve it. Right. And AEP Ohio, we have 30 seconds left. Are they going to make more money off of these data centers with this new plan? I mean, the data centers are going to pay more.
I'm pretty sure AEP Ohio would not have supported this idea if they weren't going to make money from it.
Right. All right. We've been talking with WOSU news reporter Renee Fox. Thanks for joining us today, Renee.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.